Ho, ho, ho.
Guten Abend, lovely listeners, and it is Christmas Eve, a fitting time, I think, to discuss A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. Hello, and welcome back to Diddy and Hawthorne in the In-Between. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to my podcast about the relevancy of literature in the 21st century. Now bookmark that book, and let's begin. This episode is just going to be a cacophony of fun facts and anecdotes about the novella A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, since I'm sure we are all familiar with the age-old Christmas tale. But first, I have a few announcements for you. We have new music by Chad Crouch, an original composer and pianist. He's wonderful. What you're hearing right now is composed by him as well, and I'm so grateful that he has lent us music for the show. Second, we have a new website that has just been updated for 2019, the year of Didion. It is didionhawthorne.blueberry.net, except blueberry is spelled B-L-U-B-R-R-Y, so if you want to check that out, I read all my comments. It is a wonderful time. So to start off with some more technical facts about A Christmas Carol, it is written in staves, meaning that each of the five chapters are themselves comprehensive stories with their own distinctive moods, devices, and motivations. The book was also written within 6 weeks, so though Dickens did, over a period of years, start to hone in his ghost story craft, the format, it's still very impressive that he was able to finish such a masterpiece in that amount of time. It almost reminds me of Save Me the Waltz, Zelda Fitzgerald's one and only book, which was actually written in 4 weeks while she was staying at an insane asylum, I think in France. Another interesting aside about this work is that Dickens popularized the very American-sounding phrase Merry Christmas with A Christmas Carol, and though no one really knows why that is, or even where he came up with it, it's stuck, and it's left quite a bit of a mark, especially on American culture. To me, it makes sense that he thought a new phrase instead of Happy Christmas might have aided in a Christmas revival, but again, there's no formal explanation available as to why this phrase came up in this novel. As far as the reading experience for the novella goes, I actually quite enjoyed it, though I'm not usually one for overly sensationalized books, just because they don't feed my curiosity as much. But there are several versions of A Christmas Carol, one of which is annotated by Michael Patrick Hearn, which is a literary critic and author, and it has tons of fun facts inside of it, so if you're into that kind of thing, I've never read it. But the concept really reminds me of when the Criterion Collection restores films like The Earrings of Madame Day or The Darjeeling Unlimited, where the director makes a running commentary of the film so you can just switch it on, like subtitles almost. And the fun facts are really invaluable, and I've really enjoyed my experience with that kind of thing. So if you want a book version, there it is. Anywho, Dickens, like we have explored before, has a strong moral compass, and he often used his works rhetorically, or in other words, as vehicles to promote his various agendas. Some of those positions include his long-standing fight against poverty, in continuity with the belief that poverty promotes crime, his conviction that children, able-bodied and disabled children alike, should have systems in place to prevent child labor and child poverty, and finally his moral charge that human nature is malleable instead of rigid. In his personal life, Dickens was constantly fighting an uphill battle with all of those closely held beliefs. For example, he had a nephew that was disabled and impoverished, and he actually died, unfortunately, despite Dickens' best attempts to pay for doctors to save him. The impetus for Tiny Tim, actually, this nephew, along with other personal tragedies, served as a source of both moral integrity and literary inspiration. A Christmas Carol was published in 1844 when Dickens was 31 years old, and after a run-in with his publishers that caused him to switch publishing houses, the book was released, creating an instant sensation. Do you remember what I said in the last episode about how Christmas traditions were waning in Britain in the 1840s and 50s? Well, though the literary tradition of writing about ghosts at Christmas time was in fact deteriorating, Dickens, in a desperate attempt to repair his finances and moral position with writing, began publishing spoofs like The Christmas Carol off of the traditional ghost story format, which were met with acclaim and widespread popularity. He wasn't the only one who wanted Christmas back, though, and the book's publication was met with the first commercialized Christmas cards ever made. Before then, for context, people were actually socially obligated to write lengthy and heartfelt letters to their friends, family, and even acquaintances, so the invention of the Christmas card simplified and commercialized that whole process. The original illustrations for the work were done by John Leech, and they are rather impressive, especially since they were recently remastered in full color. Leech himself was a popular illustrator, best known for the comic cartoon Punch, first published in 1841 in Britain, of course. And if you want to hear more about him, I'm publishing an episode next year that I just pre-recorded about the history of comics, a richer topic than one might think. Back to A Christmas Carol, the novella has never in its nearly 200 years of publication been out of print. This astonishing fact has led to hundreds of adaptations, as I mentioned before, and many of you have been saying that you missed the covers portion from Horrifying Classics, so here are five of my favorite covers of A Christmas Carol. I would be remiss not to start with a mention of the Christmas Carol musical, which was adapted shortly after its initial release in the mid-1840s. Dickens held the rather eclectic position of doing public readings of his books and some special writings, and there are whole stories of him drinking things like a sherry with a raw egg in it beforehand, but due to those readings as well as the accompanying illustrations, his works often took on a theatrical nature from the start. That being said, the reviews for the original show are really, really bad, but I actually listened to some of it on YouTube and I found it quite charming. It's unclear what version I was listening to though, so listener beware. Next is the Jim Carrey version of A Christmas Carol, directed by Robert Zemeckis. Okay, this is the version that I grew up watching, so I suppose I don't have the liberty to say much shade about it, but what I can say is that this is a digitized version, and Scrooge is the Scrooge I have always and will always envision when thinking about A Christmas Carol. I just can't shake it. When I read more about this version, though, it's heralded particularly for its character design, which obviously makes sense based on my experience with Jim Carrey's Scrooge. Number 3, Mrs. Scrooge, is a movie from 1997 that reimagined the original story from quite a different angle. I personally had never heard of this film before researching it, and I'm not sure if I'm going to watch it after reading about it because it seems a bit sketchy. The cast includes Oscar-nominated Cicely Tyson and Katherine Hillman, who are pretty good actresses considering, but however, the movie revolves around Ebenezer Scrooge, and it has several glaring diversions from the original text that are said to take away from the movie instead of adding to it. Number 4 is a mashup between all of the popularized versions of The Christmas Carol, of which there are many, so I'm just going to list a few. The Flintstones, Mickey Mouse, Muppets, Scooby-Doo, Simpsons, SpongeBob, Futurama, Looney Tunes, and many, many more. Finally, number 5, this last one is probably fairly obscure, but I'm intrigued because Patrick Stewart plays Scrooge. I will never forget, partly because the experience scarred me, but partly because it was invaluable, the time that we watched Patrick Stewart's Macbeth in freshman English. I would, after some distance from it, recommend it. It was just a bit graphic, I think, for my freshman year self. Patrick Stewart is known for King Richard, Macbeth, and Professor X, which I have verified with my brother is from X-Men, so it's clear that he has a bit of range with acting. It's not super highly rated, I think, because of the technical effects as well as the other cast members, but still interesting to note and look at. Finally, as I mentioned earlier, this novella was written both as a plea for the well-being of children as well as a piece to bring back Christmas celebrations, and there is one part of the story that is left out almost 100% of the time in adaptations. There's a part near the end when the ghost of the present is leaving Scrooge and he notices some odd movements and little things that he thinks are tentacles or something from underneath the present's robe. The movements belong to two children, Ignorance and Want, who center the story morally and secure the story's position on poverty. It is implied, furthermore, that Ignorance and Want, when left to fester and grow up, turn into hideous human beings. This instance over everything was why I was able to keep my intrigue while reading A Christmas Carol, and why you should read it as well. If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from me, there's an episode of DH&I for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our back catalog of episodes, which is available on whatever podcasting app you're using. If you need some guidance, try episode 11 about perspective-changing books. That's perfect for the new year if you are compiling a reading list. 2019 is the year of Didion, so if you'd like to follow along in my quest to read Joan Didion's collective works or learn more about the movement to bring lit back to people, everything can be found at didionandhawthorne.blueberry.net. And remember that blueberry is spelled B-L-U-B-R-R-Y. Now you can also follow the show on Twitter with @DidionIn, 2 N's total. I'll be posting about new lit releases, reading lists, and of course the new projects and episodes relating to DH&I. Also stay tuned for the next episode in A few days' time on Saturday, Kristen Alisea is coming back on the show, and we will be looking at all of the books that we read in 2018. Still there? One more thing then. Remember that leaving a comment or review on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or any other Guilty Pleasure podcast platform helps leverage the show so that other literature enthusiasts can find the community. In other words, it helps a ton. Merry Christmas for those of you who celebrate Christmas, and we'll see you on Saturday.